Today we begin here with the Mishnah on the top of Kuf Lamed Amud Aleph. Just as a reminder, this Mishnah doesn't stand alone. It's actually connected to the previous Mishnah. And in the previous Mishnah on Kuf Chavav Amud Bet, there we said, Homer Ish Ploni Bini Bechor Lo Yitol Pishnaim. I say about my son, who's the eldest son, that he will not inherit his double portion. Or Ish Ploni Bini Lo Yirash Mechav. Or so-and-so, my son, will not inherit along with his brothers. Lo amar klum. He is not successful at doing any of that. Because shehit na'amah shekatuv b'Torah. Because there you are going against the protocols of the Torah with regards to Yerusha. And you don't have the ability to change what the Torah dictates with regards to Yerusha. On the other hand, we saw before that if you used a matana in that Mishnah, then you can do it. You can gift the property prior to the death. Because then that's not going against the Torah's prescription for Yerusha. Now we have the continuation of that Mishnah. Omer ish ploni yirasheni b'makom sheish bat. Person says, so-and-so will inherit me, but there is a daughter to inherit him. Biti tirasheni, my daughter will inherit me, b'makom sheish ben. In the case or a situation where there is a son. So you are changing the order of the Yerusha in the Torah. The Torah dictates that if there are no sons, the daughter has the right to the Yerusha, and instead you're allocating the Yerusha to someone else. Or in a case where there are sons, and you're allocating the Yerusha to the daughter, in those cases, lo amar klum. He didn't successfully do anything. He does not accomplish anything with the Yerusha. Shehitna mashakatuv b'Torah. Because again, over here, he's making a tanai, a condition of Yerusha that goes against the prescription of the Torah. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka Omer, and here's Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka we've heard so much about all through the Perek. Im amar al mishra uli yorsho, if he says it about someone who is rightfully an heir to his Yerusha, dvarav kayamim, then whatever he does or whatever he says is successful. V'amisha ein ro uli yorsho, on the other hand, if it's someone who is not a rightful heir to the Yerusha, ain't dvarav kayamin. Then he is unsuccessful at accomplishing what he wants to do, or we're not bound by that which he said. So we're here in this Mishnah, including the previous Mishnah, you have three different statements of the Mishnah. And of course, the question is, what are the differences or similarities between those statements, and whose opinions are we speaking about in each of these cases? It's clear in the end that we have Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's opinion, but the two statements before that, the one in this Mishnah here, which says that if you try to favor an alternate party, you are unsuccessful, as well as in the previous Mishnah, where it says if you try to disinherit a bechor or disinherit a child, that you are unsuccessful. So those are the three different pieces of the Mishnah. And the question of, or the attribution of, the authorship or the backing for those positions. The Gemara makes a diuk at the beginning of our Mishnah, which is, Taima da'acher b'makom bat. The reason that it fails in the beginning of the Mishnah here is because you tried to give it to another party when there was a daughter that was available to be an heir. Or bat b'makom ben. Or in a situation where you tried to give it to the daughter where there were sons who would have taken precedence. That's why it fails. Ha, what you would conclude from that, what you would infer from that is ben abanim. If you gave it to one of the sons amongst the other sons, ubat ben abanot, or you gave it to one of the daughters amongst the other daughters, divarav kayamim. You would be successful at doing that. The failure here in the Mishnah is because you tried to alter the Yerusha. You tried to give precedence to a third party when there's a daughter. You tried to give precedence to a daughter when there is a son. The implications of that are, if you're trying to give a son precedence over other sons, or a daughter precedence over other daughters, it would work. That'd be totally fine. Well, if you do say that, and if you are medayak that, ema seifa. What are you going to do with the latter half of the Mishnah? Where's Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka? Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka omer, im amar al mishra uili yorsho, dvarav kayamim. If you say something about someone who is a rightful heir to the Yerusha, then what you say is binding. Or in essence, what Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka is seemingly saying, and this is how we've interpreted him until now, is that if you favor one son over the other sons, that's fine, because that son is a rightful heir, and if you give him 100% of the allocation, that works. But that means now, Hainu Tanakama. Then Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka and the Tanakama are saying the exact same thing. Because we're medayik out of the Tanakama, that if you favor one son over other sons, fine. If favor a daughter over the other daughters, fine. And that's exactly what Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha has been telling us till now, is that's what we've understood there. B'chiteima, so if you want to suggest that you misunderstood Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha, that Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha, afilo acher b'makom bat, ka'amar, that even if you go to a third party when there is a daughter, ubat b'makom ben, or you give it to a daughter in the face of children, in that case, he would agree that it works. Because you could interpret the word ra'ui liyorsho in two ways. Ra'ui liyorsho can either be in the more narrow sense, which we've been explaining it until now, which is a rightful heir at the current time. One son amongst the other sons. You can allocate more to one child over the other children because they're all rightful heirs, and you can determine the allocation between the different children. If you have a daughter, one daughter amongst the other daughters, you can favor that daughter in the allocation. What we thought until now is you can't do is give it to someone, even though they're a rightful heir, but in the hierarchy of Yerusha, they're not available now. Just a daughter versus sons, you can't grant it to the daughter because right now you have sons and they take precedence. So giving it to the daughter would not be giving it to a rightful heir. That's how we've explained it until now. What the Gemara suggests now is, you know, maybe ra'ui liyorsho doesn't mean somebody who is a rightful heir currently, but someone who could potentially be an heir to the Yerusha. That means that if you have sons and a daughter, and you allocate it to the daughter, that'll be fine. Because a daughter is a rightful heir, just not now, because they're sons. If there were no sons, she would have been a rightful heir. So maybe that's what Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha means when it says ra'ui liyorsho. Ra'ui liyorsho means you can't give it to your neighbor, but you give it to your daughter because your daughter is in line for the Yerusha. The Rashbam himself qualifies the statement and says, it's only if you are one step removed from the current Yerusha. He says, V'im ein ra'ui liyorsho achar bito, kagon dodo, v'yesh lo achim. If he says, you know what, I'm going to give it to my uncle, but the individual has brothers, dachim kodnim acheav. Your brothers take precedence over your uncles. Lo amar klum. Then he didn't say anything, even according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha. Ho v'ein ra'ui liyorsho achar tamut bito v'echav. In order for that Yerusha to reach that person, you'd have to have two lines of inheritance pass away. You'd have to have the daughter pass away and the brothers pass away before the uncles are in line. So what the Rashbam does is limits this concept that we expand Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha to mean anybody who's in line in the inheritance, it means the next in line. So therefore, when you're talking about sons, a daughter is next in line. When you're speaking about a daughter, the father is next in line. Speaking about the father, next in line is the brothers. So when we say ra'ui liyorsho, it just means that you could step it one down in the hierarchy of the Yerusha, not that you can give it to anybody who could potentially be Yoresh, because in the end, the truth is that everybody in the world, as long as you are Jewish, potentially could be a Yoresh, because you go back far enough, we all come from a common denominator, we all come from Yaakov Avinu. So that's not what it means, Ra'ui liyorsho. Ra'ui liyorsho is limited to the next person behind the current inheritors. So in the case of sons, that would be a daughter would be right behind them. In the case of daughters, then right behind them would be the father. So in those cases, maybe that's what Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha would meant. You can allocate it to the daughter in the face of sons, or you can allocate it to the father in the face of a daughter. And that would be differentiated from the Tanakhama, who says you can only allocate amongst sons when there are sons, and you can only allocate amongst daughters when there are daughters. You can't move down one notch in the hierarchy in the face of sons or daughters. And that's how we would differentiate Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha from the Tanakhama, or the Diok out of the Tanakhama. The reasoning behind Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha's position will be discussed after we figure out what he's saying in the Mishnah, and then the Gemara will discuss what is the source for this. So Gemara says, Va'atanya, the problem with saying that that is the position of Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha is, we actually have a statement from his son who tells us where he argues. Rabbi Shmuel benosh Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha omer, lo nechluku abba v'chachamim, my father and the chachamim did not argue about this issue of Yerusha, alacher b'makom bat, about a third party in the face of a daughter. Here the third party, again, according to the Rashbam, would be the father, who would be the next in line of the father of the deceased, who would be next in line for the Yerusha. Ubat b'makom ben, in a case where there's a daughter in the face of sons, everybody agrees there, shalom arklom. Even my father agrees that that is a meaningless statement. Ama nechluku. So then where is the machloket between the chachamim and my father? Al ben ben abanim, ubat ben abanot. She'aba omer, yirash, v'shachamim omerim lo yirash. My father says that it is successful when you reallocate amongst yoshim. The chachamim say you may not do that, it's not successful. It's only with one son amongst the sons there, the allocation of the Yerusha, Rabbi Yochanan ben Rocha says you can do as you please, whereas the Chachamim say that you have to follow the equal prescription of the Torah, which is all sons will inherit equally, chutz min ha-bechor, obviously would get a double portion, or if it is a daughter amongst the daughters, they split it evenly, you can't reallocate it. Rabbi Yochanan ben Rocha believes you can reallocate it. So now once you've done that, you now have a problem, which is, this Mishnah seemingly has the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yochanan ben Rocha saying the same thing. Rabbi Shmuel says Rabbi Yochanan ben Rocha only argues when you're talking about a son amongst the sons or a daughter amongst the daughters, you're allowed to reallocate as you please. And the Tanakhama, the deal from the Tanakhama is only when you are moving the Yerusha to a party that is not a direct heir or a current heir to your Yerusha, does it fail. But that means if you did it amongst those that were rightfully heirs to your Yerusha currently, you'd be fine. And that's what the Gemara said before, Rabbi Yochanan ben Rocha, Hainu Tanakhama. How do you differentiate between them? So Ibai Tema, so Gemara gives two possible resolutions to this problem. Mija Kamar, Lo Nechleku, by the fact that Rabbi Shmuel, Benosh Rabbi Yochanan ben Rocha says, Lo Nechleku, they don't argue about this. Michlal, the Tanakhama Savar, Nechleku. There must be a dissenting opinion to Rabbi Shmuel's position. Rabbi Shmuel makes a grandiose statement which says, my father and the Chachamim don't argue about this issue. They only argue about this very narrow case, in the case where you have sons and you want to reallocate amongst the sons. You have daughters and you want to reallocate amongst the daughters. That's where the machloket is. But other than that, no machloket between my father and the Chachamim. Implicit in his statement is that he is addressing someone, or that he is answering someone who seems to indicate otherwise. And that would be a Tanakhama that we don't see, but possibly the Tanakhama or the Tana of our Mishnah, who says that that's not true. They actually argue, even in a case where you're speaking about moving the Yerusha from sons to a daughter, or moving the Yerusha from a daughter to the father of the deceased. They do argue in that case. So that's one solution to the problem. One solution to the problem is to say the Tanakhama in our Mishnah here says, number one, if you move Yerusha around between different levels of Yerusha, you fail. You try to move it to a daughter when you have sons, fails. You try to move it to the father when you have daughters, fails. If you keep it within that level of the Yerusha, you will be successful. Ben Abanim. You want to give it to one of the sons amongst the sons? Totally fine. One of the daughters amongst the daughters? Totally fine. That's the Tanakhama. Yochanan ben Rocha comes along to say, even if you move it down a notch in the Yerusha, it's fine. You want to give it to a daughter when you have sons? Fine. You want to give it to a father of the deceased when there is a daughter? That's fine. Rabbi Shmuel's son says his father doesn't argue in that case. The fact that Rabbi Shmuel is saying that implies that someone else disagreed with that. And that's the Tana of our Mishnah who disagrees and says Rabbi Yochanan ben Rocha even argues when you give it to another party. You have a right to redistribute the Yerusha, not only amongst those that are the current heirs to your Yerusha, but even someone who's next in line according to the Rishbam. Obviously, if you don't live with the limitation of the Rishbam, it would be anybody who is a rightful heir to the Yerusha. You can reallocate it as you please. So that's one solution to the problem, is to say that we actually, in some sense, might have three positions in our Mishnah. We have the position in the previous Mishnah that says that if you try to disinherit the Bechor or disinherit a child, you fail. We have the Tanakhama over here who says you can't move Yerusha in the hierarchy from one level to the next level, but within a level of Yerusha, you can allocate it as you please. And then we have Rabbi Yochanan ben Rocha who says you can even move it from one level of the Yerusha to another level of the Yerusha. You have free reign in terms of allocating the Yerusha. So that would be one way to explain the Mishnah and having three different positions in the Mishnah. Ibai Tema, the other alternative is Kulei the Rabbi Yochanan ben Rocha. The entire Mishnah is authored by Rabbi Yochanan ben Rocha. V'chasurei mechzera. And you're missing words. When we say we're missing words, usually it means we're missing transition words. There's a transition here that's missing, which is V'achiktani. Omer ish ploni yirasheni b'makom sheyesh bat. He says, so-and-so should inherit me in the face of a daughter. Biti tirasheni b'makom sheyesh ben. Or my daughter should inherit me in the face of sons. By the way, the language of the Gemara seems to go against what the Rishbam concluded. The Rishbam said it's only if you move it to the next level of Yerusha. Over here, the way that the Gemara phrases it is, I want to give it to a third party instead of my daughter. Doesn't say the next in line, which would have been either the father of the deceased or the brothers of the deceased. We don't see that. He just says, I want to give it to someone else besides the daughter. Over there, lo amar klum, you are unsuccessful at doing that. Habat ben abanot, uben ben abanim. But if it's a daughter amongst the daughters, you want to reallocate the percentage that goes to that daughter. Or a son amongst sons, imamar yirash kol nechasav, you want to give them 100% of the allocation, divarav kiyayimim. He is successful at doing so. And here's the little addition, sheh, Rabbi Yochanan Omer. Because Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka tells you, imamar al mish yirao ili yosho, dvarav kiyayimim. Because if he makes the statement about someone who is ra'oi to inherit him, then whatever he says is binding. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka is giving you the principle behind what is said in the previous statement of the Mishnah. So then, in this view, you would have Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka be the author of this section of the Mishnah. The question that would arise is the first Mishnah. Does Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka agree with that piece in the first Mishnah, or disagree with that piece in the first Mishnah? The answer to that we actually discussed when we read that Mishnah, which is it possible that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka would agree with the first part of the Mishnah because of the way that it's formulated? It is a negative formulation which says, I am disinheriting one of my children. I am disinheriting the Bechor from his Bechorah. Maybe Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka agrees in that case that you fail because of the way you articulated it. If you articulate it in a positive allocation, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka believes that's fine. But when you allocate it by disinheriting someone, saying it in a negative formulation, maybe Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says that doesn't work. Or as we're going to see later, that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka believes that you can't move around the Chilek HaBechorah, even though you're allowed to do elder allocations. And then you could really say Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka is the author of the entire Mishnah. And there are those that go as far as to say that when you disinherit the Bechor, the two are so intertwined that if you disinherit the Bechor, you also fail at Vayah B'yomun Chilo Ad Banav. Because the two are connected in the Pasuk, and therefore if you disinherit the Bechor, you also lose your right or your empowerment to reallocate the Yerusha. On the other hand, there are those that believe that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says you can disinherit a child. You can say 100% to you, 0% to you. And just like that, you can reallocate. And therefore the statement in the beginning of the Mishnah would belie a different position. And it would be the Tanakama versus what we have here, which is the position of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Now, in the situation here, the Rashbam points out, in the two solutions to the problem, the second solution is what we just described here, which is to say this entire Mishnah that we have on this Amud is Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. And we discussed the question as to the first Mishnah, whether that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka can fit into that position or not. And the other alternative was to say that in our Mishnah here, you have a Tanakama who says that Ben Ben Abanim and Bat Ben Abanot, you can reallocate as you please. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says you can even reallocate amongst other parties. So then the Rishbam over here explains, then what is the Chiddush in the Mishnah? Before you said, but can't say, I'm disinheriting such and such a child, or I am taking it away from the Bechor. Then you come over here and say, Ish plani yirasheni b'makom sheyesh bat, biti tirasheni b'makom sheyesh ben, and there we say it fails. Of course it fails. If you can't take away Yerusha from one party, then of course if you try to allocate it to someone who is not even on that level, it should fail. Then what's the point of writing this part of the Mishnah over here? So the answer to that is the diuk. The diuk out of that is the important part, and the diuk is in two directions. One direction is to teach you the power of the Rabbanon. One is to teach you the power of the Tanakama, to teach you that only in a case where you're moving between levels of Yerusha does it fail. But to allocate within that level of Yerusha, that is successful. That's one Chiddush you learn out of here. The second Chiddush you will learn out of here is that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka argues and says, even in the case where you're allocating between different levels, it does work. And that's the diuk that you're learning out. So this line here, even though it's obvious, the halacha that's being written here is obvious. If you said before that you can't take away Yerusha from a child, or you can't disinherit the Bechor, then certainly you can't move it between different levels of Yerusha. So what's the point of writing it in this Mishnah? The answer is, not because of that halacha, but what derives from that halacha. One is it teaches us that the Tanakhama believes if you keep it on the same level of Yerusha, you can allocate it as you please. And number two is it teaches that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka argues on this point and says you can give it to a daughter in the face of sons. You can give it to another party in the face of daughters. And that's why this line of the Mishnah is important. Not because of its inherent halacha that comes from it, because that's obvious that you can't move it between different levels. If you can't take it away from a child, then obviously you can't take it away from a whole bunch of sons and give it to a daughter. But the diuk from that tells you something about the Tanakhama's position, and also tells you something about Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's position. And that's the importance of that statement here, at least according to the first way you explain the Mishnah, that this Tanakhama and Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka are arguing in the Mishnah over here. Right now, the Gemara says, I'm Rabbi Yehuda Mishmuel, halacha ke Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. The Gemara here concludes that despite the fact that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka is enumerated as a dat yachid over here, nevertheless, the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. B'chein amar Rava, Rava also has a similar view. Halacha ke Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. The halacha follows Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Over here, the way that the Rishbam explains it is, ukedemashma stama matnitin. It's like our Stam Mishnah over here that seems to indicate that ben abanim is considered to be okay. Ukedeyakimna, like we set it up, that kulei Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. The entire Mishnah is Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Because if you do that, then it switches it from being Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka dat yachid that's arguing, to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka being a Stam Mishnah. And therefore, attributing the authorship of the Mishnah to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, which means that we treat him like plurality, that he has an opinion that's not just a dat yachid, but we consider him to be like the Chachamim. So if you explain the Mishnah as being authored by Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka through and through over here, and you have to add in the little shin there to say, shin Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka Omer, that's because Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says this, that means the first part of the Mishnah is attributed to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, and that means you have a Stam Mishnah like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. And for that reason, you would paskin like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. The way that the Rishbam goes on to explain it is, that's all. When we say halacha like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, that's the limit of what we're going to say. Ben abanim, bat ben abanot. That we will say the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. You can reallocate it as you please. We will not say that the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka in the explanation that we gave, that he possibly would allow you to move to a daughter in the face of sons, or to another heir in the face of daughters. We will not go as far to say that and say the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka in that case for a number of reasons. First of which is, his son Rabbi Yishmael says that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka doesn't argue in that case. He agrees with the Chachamim that it doesn't work. He only argues about a case when it is a son amongst the sons or a daughter amongst the daughters. He doesn't allow for you to move from level to level in Yerusha. And therefore, Rabbi Yishmael would be a important source to say that the limitation of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka is ben abanim and bat ben abanot. So that's first of all. Second of all, he said, the Rishbam points out that numerous times we have seen throughout this perek, the explanation of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka is ben abanim and bat ben abanot. That was our assumption until we hit today's Gemara. That's what we assumed, that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka allowed you to allocate between parties of a similar level of Yerusha. You could give 100% to this one, 25, 30, whatever you want, you could reallocate it, but you have to stay on that level of Yerusha. So that's the second thing. So first of all, Rabbi Yishmael saying that's the limitation of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's argument. Number two is, the quotes of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka until now in this parak have all indicated that was the explanation of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. And therefore, when we say over here, these Amoraim say, Alocha ke Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, we are saying or limiting it to the case of ben abanim, that the Rishbam says over here, and you can see the Baya Tosafot say the same thing. Nirad the Dafka ben abanim, Ubat ben abanot, Kepirish Rabbeinu Shmuel. The way that the Rishbam explained it, that's what we're saying over here, that the locha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Now, he goes on to add after that, that if a person is doing this allocation, the loshnaim amar, loshna kotev. It doesn't matter if he's doing this through a verbal transmission, he is telling you this is how he wants to allocate it, or whether he actually writes it down in his will, that this is the way that he wants it to be distributed. And therefore, whether he does it in verbal expression, or he writes it down, in those cases, we will carry out his wishes and reallocate the Yerusha based on his statements. So if he has multiple sons, he can reallocate it to the sons, either by expressing to us as a shchiv meirah, that's what he wants to happen, or write down in a will that is his will to have it allocated amongst the children in the following manner. But Rishbam goes on to explain, V'arminan hu adin nami livno, dimkatav lo kol nechasav, lo asau ele apitropo, hanamile kotev lashon matana, omer lashon natana. The Rishbam is faced with a problem, which was what precipitated his stating, that it doesn't matter if he writes it, or if he verbally expresses it, that we consider it to be what he wanted to happen. And that's because the Gemara says that if you write in your will that you want the wife to be the possessor of all your assets, or you want one of your children to be the possessor of all your assets, and you gift it to them, it says, if you wrote all your assets or gave all your assets to your wife, you made her the executor of the estate, you did not really grant her the ownership over those rights. The same is true by a child. If he gifted him all of his possessions, you only made him into an executor of the estate, you did not give him ownership. That's only if he does it as a gift. Omer lashon matana, or he says it as a gift. Dilich vodo ikavein. It is giving an honor to that person. Lalo lo nachasav. He is not really giving him ownership over the item. He's simply saying you'll be in charge of the assets of the estate. So when he says or grants it as a gift, where he gifts all of his property to his wife, or he gifts all of his property to a particular child, we don't take him literally. We don't take him at face value. Say the only reason he did that was because he wanted to honor that person with being the controlling figure in the estate, the executor of the estate. Meaning that you will decide or you will work on the allocations, but the allocations will remain what they were supposed to, which is that the wife won't get the assets, the children will get the asset. The one child will not get the asset, it'll be split equally, but that child or the wife will be the one who does the allocations or distributes the assets as needed. Aval lishon yerusha. And this is what the Rishpam contrasts that with. If you write it as a Yerusha, if you write it as an inheritance, Hakol Kedin Torah, that is according to the Din Torah, which is that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says when you write something as Yerusha, you're not going against the Torah. Your reallocation of those items is permissible. And since it's permissible, when you write it as Yerusha, we will carry out that will at face value or at its word. Which is that if you now, through Yerusha, say it all goes to one child, we will give it all to that one child. Because it's no longer a gift where we can reinterpret it and say the gift wasn't literally a gift of the rights. It was a gift of the execution of the distribution, and we're just doing it to honor him. When you say Yerusha, you mean Yerusha, and we will carry out your order, whether it is written or expressed orally. Because the way the Rashbam explains it is because, it's a very interesting comment, he says here that if you make somebody into the executor of the estate, nitkaima matanato, sheyesh notein matana gmura, v'yesh lememar dhikne lo lo chasim liot b'cheskatan ki divin atropo. Sometimes when a person gifts the property, you can do it in one of two ways. You can be gifting literally the rights, the ownership of the property, or you can be gifting the control of those rights, which means to make them into the executor. So then, if we have a choice, when he writes, I'm gifting all my property to one child, and we can interpret it either to say he literally meant give all my property to that one child, or he meant that that child should be the executor of the estate, we will interpret it to mean he should be the executor of the estate, because in that way, you will distribute the assets in a more fair manner, which means to all the children. Rather than disinherit all the other children, we'd favor making this person executor of the estate, saying that accomplishes what he wanted to happen, and therefore they're going to get it allocated equally. Because even when you make him into apitropos, you gave that gift. But, on the other hand, when you give Yerusha, there's only one way to carry out the Yerusha. That if you make him into an apitropos, that's not called Yerusha. Inheritance, by definition, means you step into the shoes of the bequeather. You become the owner of the assets, like the bequeather was. And so the meaning of Yerusha literally means ownership. And therefore, there's only one way to interpret it. If he says, I want my son to inherit all the property, even though there are five other sons, we will have to carry those instructions out literally, and he will get that Yerusha, because according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, that is allowed by the Torah. It doesn't go against the Torah. You're not matneah mashakadub the Torah. And we will grant that ownership to that particular individual. So it's an important Rashbam that distinguishes between matana and Yerusha. By matana, we will reinterpret the statement to make him into an executor, because in that way, you still will get a fair allocation to the children, and probably prevent a lot of fighting after the fact, but just make this person the executor and carry out his will in that way. On the other hand, if he writes Yerusha, you have no choice but to carry out what he says, and then you allocate it all to that one child, because you are permitted, we'll see in a second, min haTorah, according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, to do such. So now, the Gemara says, Amar Rava, my time in the Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. We've heard Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka throughout the Perek. We never heard what's the reasoning behind Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's position. And that is because Amar Kra, the Pasuk says, it says, on the day that he bequeaths his inheritance to his children. As the Rashbam points out, there's no reason to use the word hinchilo over here, because you could have written b'yom shin yanchilu banav, on the day that his children inherit. Inheritance happens in a passive form. You don't need an active verb to have Yerusha pass to the next generation. When the person passes away, by definition, the bequeathing happens. That means that the passive verb would have been sufficient over here. You could just say, on the day that the children inherit. The fact that it uses the active verb over here, hinchilo, on the day that you bequeath to the children, that sounds like you have a right to do the bequeathing. Well, how's that possible? If all that happens is when you die, the prescription of the Torah kicks in, then you're not doing anything. So the Ben Hinchilo teaches you that nitna rishut avlan chil nochom mishu yirtzeh. The father is empowered to give the Yerusha to whomever he chooses. Obviously, it's not to whomever he chooses. It means to allocate it amongst the sons that are there, to allocate it amongst those individuals that are the rightful heirs at this time. But that is an empowerment that the Torah grants him, and therefore you're not going against the Torah when you allocate it to a particular child, or you allocate it not evenly between the different children. Just to note that according to the reading of the Mishnah that says that Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch allows reallocation of assets even away from the rightful heirs, meaning that you can give it to a daughter in the face of sons, then you have to read the pasuk of Vaya b'yom hinchilo et banav, you have to read it as not being literal. Because otherwise, b'yom hinchilo et banav, when you can reallocate it amongst your sons, but you can't reallocate it to different levels. So that's what the Rashbam says over here. It doesn't mean sons, but it means sons in the terms of your shav, those that inherit him, those that are the rightful heirs to your property, not the direct heirs, meaning your sons. Because otherwise you can't explain then his reasoning from Vayah b'yom hinchilo et banav. And so he says it's banav lav dafka. Amar lei Abaye, ha milo yuchal levaker nafka. Wait a minute. That's not where you learn it from. You learn it out of the fact that in the same pasuk it says, lo yivachal levaker, it's a ben ahuva. You're not allowed to favor the child that you love over the real bechor. So you're not allowed to reallocate the bechorah to the child that you like better when there is a child who is the snua, the ben snua, who is disliked. You can't disinherit him from the bechorah and give it to someone else. Why does the Torah have to tell you can't favor this individual? Because further on it already says, ki'et bechor ben snua yakir. It tells you who you must give the double portion to. So why do you need a negative formulation to say that he may not give the double portion to someone else? Or you may not favor another party as the bechor. The implications are that you only may not move around the chelek ha-bechorah, but the chelek ha-pshuta, you could move around. The Torah seems to indicate that there's only a restriction against reallocating who the bechor is, but reallocating who the pshutim are, or what the distribution is amongst the pshutim, that would work. That's the diuk out of this statement. As the Baal Yitzchak Fuld point out, not only is this a problem for Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, but it's also a problem for the Chachamim. The Chachamim are also faced with this, lo yuchal levaker, that you're not allowed to favor the Bechor over the other party. And what he says, you could even ask this on the Rabbanan themselves, because they have to do something with lo yuchal levaker, which implies that you're only not allowed to move around the Chelek HaBechorah, but the Chelek HaPshitut, you would be able to move around. So the question can either be on the source of Rabbi Yochanan ben Baruch coming from Rabbi Yom b'Chanchilo, because I could have learned it out of Lo Yuchal Levaker, or it could be a fundamental question on the Chachamim. What do you do with Lo Yuchal Levaker, which implies that you are allowed to move around the Yerusha as long as it's not the Chelek HaBechorah. It says, we need that statement, look at it, Tanya, for the Braita. Abba Chanan Amar Mishum Rabbi Eliezer, Ma Talmud Lomar, what is meant by the pasuk of Lo Yuchal Levaker, that you may not favor the favored son? The Fish Nemar, Vaya B'yom Chilo et Banav. Because the other part of the pasuk says that you have a right to bequeath, you have a right to move it around. Sheachol alo denu uma pashut sheyafek kocho. When you come to a pashut who has a stronger tie to the inheritance, notel b'ra'oi k'mukzak, in a case where the property is not yet in the estate, its property on the come, a pashut has a right to that inheritance. That means if a child passed away and then his children come to collect the yerusha, even with items that are not in the estate at the time of the passing of the father, they have rights to collect it. Meaning that a person has a right to all assets of the estate, whether they are available and there at the time of the passing of the deceased, or if they come in the future. In the future, somehow, the yerusha has passed that individual because either a bequeather outlived him, or because there was a loan repaid, or all the other scenarios that we saw before. A pashut has a right to that. HaTorah nitna rishut avla hanchil. And over there, the Torah gives him, the father, the right to distribute the chol mishirtze to wherever he wants. Bechor, shu rakocho, bechor, which doesn't have such a right, she'en otol beroi kumukzak, the bechor only has the rights to a double portion in that which is available in the estate at the moment of death, when the person passes away. Things that come in the future, he does not get a double portion in. Lo kol shekein, then certainly the father should have a right to reallocate that chelik ha-bechora. To reallocate the chelik ha-pshitut, which you have many, which your rights to it are much stronger than the chelik ha-bechora, which is a weaker right, then you certainly should be able to move it around. Talmud Omar, lo yuchal levaker. That's what you need the second puzzle to come teach you, that despite the fact that you have a right to move around the allocations of the inheritance, you do not have a right to reallocate the chelik ha-bechora. V'yomar, so then why not just write, lo yuchal levaker? Just then, instead of writing both lo yuchal levaker and hayom b'yom mukhilo, just write lo yuchal levaker. Ma talmud omer vaya b'yom hanchilo et banav. So then what I need the pasuk of vaya b'yom hanchilo. Shiachol. V'lo dinu. It would be a kal v'chomer. Uma b'chor shehora kocho. By the b'chor, where he has a weaker claim on the assets of the estate. Because he can only, she'en otel b'roi mechuzak, he only takes those things that are ready and available in the estate at the passing of the individual. But things that come in the future, he does not have a double portion. Amra Torah, lo yuchal levaker. Over there, the Torah limits the father's ability to reallocate those assets. Pashut, shiafek kochol. You're talking about a regular child, not a bechor, where notel b'roi kumukzak, his claim on the assets is stronger. Because not only does he get the available assets at the time, but even future assets that come into the estate or to that bequeather, he has a right to. Lo kol shekein, then certainly the father should not have the ability to disinherit him or reallocate that allocation. Talmud Omar, that's what you need the other apostle to teach you. The father is empowered to redistribute it as he pleases. So what you see here is there's a balance between the two psukim over here according to the Braita. The Braita says, I need both psukim to teach you that there are different dinim over here. There's a din of Bechor, and despite the weakness of the Bechor's connection to those assets, the father does not have a right to pull it away from the Bechor or reallocate it away from the Bechor. On the other hand, when it comes to the Pashut, even though he does have a stronger connection to those assets, the father does have a right of reallocation. And I would not be able to learn one from the other because you would actually learn the opposite if you didn't have both psukim. If you told me you can move around the regular children's allocation or Yerusha, then you would think certainly I can move around the Bechor's Yerusha. That's why I need that puzzle. If I was told you can't move around the Bechor's assets, then I would think that certainly you can't move around the Pashut's assets. So therefore the two psukim give you these dinim. One din is banav, which teaches you can move around the regular children's allocations. And lo yilu chalavakir tells you cannot move around the chelek ha-bechora. So even Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka will agree that you can reallocate only that which belongs to the pshutim, but you cannot reallocate the double portion that goes to the bechor. And if you try to reallocate that, it will fail, and we will not abide by whatever allocation you are indicating. Or we will say that you're matneh mashu katub b'torah, and it fails what you're trying to do. If you give a double portion to the bechor, then the remaining children you can redistribute or allocate as you please once you've taken out the chelik ha-bechorah that belongs to the bechor. As the Balei Tosafot point out over here, this is not exactly what Abaye said. If you remember, Abaye said to Rova, why do you need vayah b'yom chelilo et banav? Because you have it from lo yuchal levaker. His deal was, lo yuchal levaker means you can't move around the bechor, but you can move around the pashut. The Braita doesn't say that in the end. The Braita says that each one of them teaches you a din, but it doesn't teach you the diuk out of lo yuchal levaker. It tells you, well, you can't move a bechor, but you can move a pashut. The Braita doesn't learn that because of the problem of roi kumukzak, which means that if you think you can't move around the bechor, you would have concluded that you also cannot move around the pashut, not the diuk that Abaye makes. So the Braita is supportive of this idea that the pasuk, it needs to be used or utilized like Abaye says, but the Braita does not make the diuk that Abaye makes, which is, you could have learned out from lo yuchal levaker that you can move around the rest of the children's allocations because of the problem of what we saw here, the kal v'chomer that the Braita brings. Amar Rav Zrika, Amar Rabbi Ami, Amar Rabbi Chanina, Amar Rabbi, halocha ki Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. So here again, we have some saying this supportive idea that the law is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Amalei Rabbi Abba, Hore Itmar. It was not that we said the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, but rather horeh. He paskined like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. But my kamiflege. What is the machloket over here between these two? They're both saying the same thing, which is the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Question is the source of this statement from Rabbi. Did Rabbi simply say the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, or did he paskin the halacha that it was like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka? But in the end, the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. So the machloket is marsavala halacha difa. One of them, meaning the first quote, thinks that when you say, if somebody says the halacha is like so-and-so, that is better evidence of the fact that the halacha is really like them. Marsavar maseh rav. The other one says that actually paskining in a case law is a stronger statement of endorsement of that position. As the Rabbeinu Gershom explains over here, marsavar sheposek halacha b'talmud b'vei midrash ikar. Marsavar ho-ra'ah ayidei maseh ikar. So the reasons being, and here we're going to see a little more of this in the Gemara in a second, but the Rashbam explains to us that when you say in the abstract, say for instance, you say the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, you're not dealing with case law, you're simply dealing with a statement in the Beit Midrash. So that is the Masa Matan, as we say. It's the back and forth of the Beit Midrash. It's an intellectual exercise by which you are trying to get to the depths of understanding of this sugya. And then you come to the conclusion that halacha ke Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. When you say that, or you come to that conclusion, that's a conclusion from the, I'll call it the banter of the learning in the Beit Midrash. But you haven't really come to a conclusion in the sense that a halacha the maisa, I would actually do this. And therefore, the saying halacha is not as strong as halacha the maisa, where you actually paskin a case. When you paskin a case, that means you're putting yourself on the line behind this psak. That means that this psak is going to go out there and be known that this is the way that you concluded. When you say in the Beit Midrash, you're throwing out a possibility. You're throwing out an opinion, and you're going to get responses to that. You maybe change your mind later on. Once you come to psak halacha, then you've now carved or etched it in stone to the point where you can't reverse that position. So that's the view that a halacha the maisa is better. On the other hand, you have a view that opposes that and says when you say halacha, it is more binding or it's more indicative of your view because whenever you look at case law is always difficult. Case law involves particular issues that might be unique to that circumstance. That means both from the particular case as well as the particular environment. It could be a horat sha'ah or it could be that you are inferring the wrong conclusion. We just saw this before in the Gemara, that two people saw Rava give a psak halacha, and they came to different conclusions as to why Rava gave that psak halacha. That means that you could see a case and think that's why they paskin this way, and you could think he's saying halacha Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, but that may not be the reasoning behind his decision. It could be that your inference is incorrect, or it could be simply that you are correct in saying that, but nevertheless, you don't know the circumstances that drove that decision. And so therefore, case law is dangerous from that perspective in conclusion because you are then interpreting a specific situation and trying to extrapolate it further. On the other hand, if someone says halacha, that means that they think the halacha is this way across the board. Irrespective of circumstance and situation or case, they think the halacha is this way. So that's the machloket here, which is better evidence of a person's opinion. When they make a statement that the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, or is it better when they pass an halacha like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka? Again, there's strengths and weaknesses to each side, and that's what we described over here, this machloket. Tan Rabbanan. Ein lemidim halacha lo mipi lamud, lo mipi maaseh, ad sheyomru lo, until the person articulates it in the following manner, halacha lemaaseh. So some people take this very literally, which is that until you get a psak halacha from an individual who says, halacha lemaaseh, this is the halacha, and you should act this way, or you can act on this halacha, that is a binding statement where the individual can be clear that whatever was being told to them is the halacha. What we don't say is, you're not allowed to, mipi maaseh, which is what we already described before, just because you saw a case, or you saw a case law being passed down, you may not conclude from that the halacha is such because of the misinterpretation. The possibility that you don't understand what is being done here, both a failure to infer the right conclusion, or even if you infer the right conclusion, you may not know all the facts, and therefore you're coming to the wrong conclusion. So you can't do that. V'lo mipi lamud. And you can't do it from that which is learnt. So this you can explain in a number of manners. Mipi lamud, you could either mean that, like you said before, when a person in the Beit Midrash says halacha like so-and-so, maybe that's just in the context of the back and forth of the learning, And it's not binding because he just said it, or he's actually putting it out, trying to think about it, or try to get illicit responses to that statement to see if other people disagree. But that may not be a binding statement. That's one way to learn it. The other way to learn it, and seemingly they had a different gear saw in the Gemara, is what the Rabbeinu Chananel, it says over here, that you may not learn out a halacha when a Mishnah says that the halacha is such and such. When you have in the Mishnah many times, there's a conclusion at the end of a Mishnah and says, halacha kidvarav, or halacha kid so and so. What the Gemara says in other places is, ein lom deim halacha min a Mishnah. You may not take halacha from a Mishnah. That means, can be interpreted one or two ways. It can mean that when it says halacha is like so and so in the Mishnah, you ignore it. That is not a binding statement. Or you can say that if you just know the Mishnayot, you can't conclude a psak from the Mishnayot. You need to know what the Gemara does with that Mishnah, how it reinterprets it, how it reconciles it with other Mishnayot, because you can't conclude from the Mishnah itself, halacha. So that's the other view of what it means. You can't learn something min alamud, and that's the way that the Rabbeinu Chananel explains that it's referencing to the Mishnah, although the Rishbam says that in that Gemara over there where it says, ein lemeidim halacha min a Mishnah, so over here he explains it differently, which is the following. Ein lemeidim halacha klomar, ein lemeidim lasot, lo mipi gemara. You see the gersa of the Rishbam is not mipi alamud, but rather mipi ha-gemara. Shim lomar arab derech limudo, v'amar mistaver time of the ploni chacham, ein talmidav lemeidim misham halacha. Teshema im yavol yado maseh yidaktek yoter, v'yiretam acher badavar. Don't allow, when he's speaking in shir, and he does, I think the halacha is probably this way, that's all he's saying. I think it's this way. Or, it sounds like it's this way, but if he got down to the nitty gritty and he had to paskin a case, he may change his mind, or he may not be willing to be makel in that case. It's a speculative statement at this point. It's not a statement that carries weight halachically. Below me pi maseh. Until you say halacha the maseh. So now, that's what the Rishbam says. Umakom acher aminan. You can't learn out of a Mishnah. Unless we pass an halacha like that party, you can't assume what's said in the Mishnah is the halacha. So now, what about what's written in the Gemara? The Gemara many times says, halacha ke Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. The Gemara brings down statements of Amoraim. What does that mean? What are the implications of that? We don't say halacha the maseh over there. We're just, the Gemara is making a statement of the halacha is like this individual. Does that mean that that's not a binding psak? Just like when you see the word halacha in the Mishnah, it's not a binding psak. Do you say when you find halacha in the Gemara, that's not a binding psak? The Rishbam writes very, very strongly against that and says, when the Gemara comes to a conclusion that that's the halacha, that is the halacha. That's the equivalent of saying halacha the maseh. And he explains it. Aval bilchot psukot bedivrei amoraim. If you have halacha psukah from the Amoraim, vadai samchinan. We definitely rely on it. The kevin shepasku mekatvum Ravashi Ravina, since they were included in the Gemara by Ravina Ravashi, shehem sof ha'ura'ah, they are the end of the period of the Amoraim. They bring conclusion to the Gemara or the canonization of the Gemara. Vadai alayu samchinan. Who else are we going to rely on? If we don't rely on them, then who is going to be the arbiter of what the halacha is like? Because over there you don't have anybody who can come after them to disagree or say otherwise. So if they're giving you a psak halacha, that seems to be a binding psak halacha that you will abide by. That means if a Mishnah gives you a psak halacha, it's not binding until you get a psak halacha from the Gemara. Aval a psak the Gemara samchinu. Kulu avu halacha lemaseh. Every one of them is halacha lemaseh. That's what the Gemara is doing. Why else write it down in the Gemara? Elim Kane, you're trying to bring halacha lemaseh. And he goes on, Da'ad kaimalon, b'bob metziah, Ravashi Ravina sof ha'ura'ah. We have in b'bob metziah that Ravina and Rashi are the end of the ura'ah. Ulami nish'al od b'shad maseh. If it comes, a case comes before you, who else are you going to ask? If you don't rely on Ravina and Ravashi, who's your next stop in the line? I mean, like, who else can you ask about this halacha? Im lo nismoch al halachot psukot b'gemara, k'mo shesidran Ravashi. And therefore, he thinks that that is considered to be a decisive halacha lemaseh when the Gemara says halacha. When the Gemara here says halacha lemaseh, it doesn't mean you have to actually say halacha lemaseh. That would be true if you're getting it orally transmitted from someone. If he says to you, halacha lemaseh, this is what I would say, that is binding and that is a good mesorah or a psak halacha. On the other hand, the Gemara, by definition, when it writes down halacha like so-and-so based on the Amoraim, that's the equivalent of saying halacha lemaseh. Because Ravina and Ravashi were closing the Gemara, and in closing the Gemara, they were indicating to you what they thought the halacha was. And if we're not going to use them as the basis for Psak, who's next in line? There's nobody after them. He brings then from the Rishalmi, Rabbi Zeir B'Shem Shmuel Amar, in the medium, lo min halachot, v'lo min hagadot, v'lo min tosefot, ela min Gemara, klomar mi divrei omaraim, from the words of the omaraim, v'lo mi pi ma'aseh katub b'mishno b'braita, and not from a Maisa that's written in a Mishnah Braita, Kigon, the Pligi Rabbi Malay, Ad Shiomru Alach Lamasek, Klomar, Kain Alach Alacha, Leich Masekain, Inami, Shiomru Alacha, Kdela Sot Masek, Kigon Shibabish Alach Hami Masek, Bali Adi, Hei Chalacha, Kdela Sot Kach, Vomela Alacha Keploni, Afa Pi Shiomru Stam, Zehu Alacha Lamasek. So even though they said a general statement, that is the equivalent of saying Alacha Lamasek. So here again, he broadens the scope of what is meant by halacha lemaaseh. One is if you come and ask for a psak halacha and they give you a psak, that's equivalent of saying halacha lemaaseh. You don't have to literally say halacha lemaaseh. That is halacha lemaaseh. Number two is if the Gemara gives you a psak halacha, that is the equivalent of saying halacha lemaaseh. And so he broadens the scope of halacha lemaaseh, not just when you articulate those particular words, but circumstances when the person is giving you a psak halacha in a case and they say to you, stam, the halacha is such and such in that case, and you could assume that is halacha lemaaseh. And number two is, in a case where the Gemara gives a conclusion, that's the equivalent of saying halacha lemaaseh. So it's not just when you specifically say the words halacha lemaaseh, but it has to be a context in which it really looks like a halacha lemaaseh, that the person, as the Rishbam says, is putting their mind to really think about it, to bring the conclusion to the statement or the question at hand. And because of that in-depth look, they come to a conclusive statement that is binding or that you can utilize as a psak halacha. Shal vamrulo halacha lemaaseh. So here the continuation of the statement is, if you ask a question and they tell you halacha lemaaseh, yilech v'yaseh maaseh, then you go out and go ahead and act on that psak halacha. Uvad shlo yidmeh. As long as you don't then go and extrapolate this to other cases. Where it says, mayu b'uvad shlo yidmeh. What do you mean you can't extrapolate? That is the whole situation of a judge. The circumstance of every judge is, I have to take previous case law, I have to take the psak halacha, and from that I have to render a psak halacha in this particular situation. There's no way you're going to get a psak halacha in every nuance or every exact case. What he has to do is he has to take what I know and then apply it to the case that is in front of me. So that's exactly how a person works in rendering a psak halacha. So I'm a Ravashi Ochi Kamar. This is what it's meant to Uvad Shlo Yidmeh B'Treifot. You know, you may not extrapolate by Treifot. Titania, Ein Omrim B'Treifot Zo Dome Luzo. We don't say by Treifot that one action has the same result as another action. Va'al Titama. And don't be so surprised by that. Shreichotcha Mikan Umeita. Because sometimes you cut the animal over here and it dies. Hotcha Mikan V'Chaita. And then you cut it in another location and it lives. The way the Rashbam explains it is, if you cut on the leg by the Tzomet HaGidin, at that location, the Tzomet HaGidin, the Gemara says that that's a treifa. So if you cut it at that location, the animal will die. If you cut it higher up on the leg, the animal will live, which is counterintuitive. If you cut the leg lower down, why should the animal die? And then when you cut it higher up, the animal should certainly die. The reason being that in the one case you hit the Tzomet HaGidin, the other case you didn't. So that's why you can't extrapolate. Just because when you cut it here it's a treifa, doesn't mean when you cut it up higher it's not a treifa or vice versa. When you cut it up there it's not a treifa. You can't say when you cut it lower it's a treifa. That's the way that the Rishbam learns. The Bali Tosafot think that that's incorrect because the Gemara uses this to show you about the case of Tzomet HaGidin. Tzomet HaGidin can't be the case they're speaking about because the Gemara uses this statement and this whole braita to show you that by Tzomet HaGidin it should be different. So therefore he says the case here is by the Tchol. By the spleen, if you puncture it on the thinner side, that it's not a treifa. And if you puncture it on the thicker side, it is a treifa. Again, that's something that's counterintuitive. You would think that the thicker wall, if it got punctured, would seal itself up or be able to manage it. The thinner wall, if it was punctured, you would think that it would be more problematic. And the halacha is just the opposite. So that's what it's saying. Don't be midameh. Don't be midameh. Or you could say it from organ to organ. Just because a hole in one organ in a certain location makes it or renders it a treifa, doesn't mean a hole in the other organ in the same type of location would render it a treifa. Rabbeinu Gershom over here brings, after bringing the example of Tzomet HaGidin, like the Rishbam says, V'ikid demifaresh, shekol adam b'tefachot. People are measured by tefach, and each tefach has a different implication. If you cut from starting from the top of the head, you cut the first tefach, the person will live because it's above the brain. You get to the second tefach, you cut over there, you hit the brain, the person becomes a trefa. Then you go below that level, and he's below the brain but above the throat or the neck, and the person survives. Cut them at the neck, the next tefach down, and they pass away, they're a trefa. Cut them below that, they're still above the heart, below the neck, they will survive. Go down another tefach and you hit the vital organs and the person dies. So he says, tefach by a person, there's a difference. Even though it's seemingly as you get closer to the vital organs, it should be more impactful. Nevertheless, every tefach has a different impact because of where different parts of the body lie. And therefore you can't conclude, just because something happens when you cut here, that the same impact will be true when you cut lower or higher than that location. So in essence, you are allowed to extrapolate in halacha. It's in certain areas of halacha where the extrapolation is incorrect, like by trefot. Trefot are dealing with unique circumstances of each item, and therefore you need a mesora to say whether it is or is not a trefa. Amalei Rav Asi l'Rav Yochanan. Ki amalei mar halacha, echein avin masa. When you tell us the halacha is such and such, what should we do? Amar lo tavidu, don't follow. When I say halacha is like such and such, don't act on that. Adamin halacha the masa. Until I tell you halacha the masa. So the Rishbam, in his explanation before, has to deal with Rabbi Yochanan now. Because Rabbi Yochanan says, when I say the halacha is such and such, he's an Amora, saying the halacha is such and such, it's not binding. Unless I say halacha namaseh. That would undermine the position that the Rishbam just stated before, that when the Gemara says halacha, that means it's a binding halacha, and it's equivalent of halacha namaseh. So why don't we say the same thing to Rabbi Yochanan? So in explaining that, he says, Ella, she Rabbi Yochanan levado haya machmir al atzmo. Rabbi Yochanan was machmir on himself. V'amar l'talmidav kilekaman. As he says to his students, like we just read, Shleis levay, shemar lehem halacha lemaaseh. V'haynu taima. The reasoning is, Dilma hodor be'mi ha'upsak. He was worried about the fact that he might retract the position or change his mind. Halacha shepasak v'ir lo tamacher be'inav. Even though he said the halacha is such, he will see that there's another reasoning or another logic that makes him change his mind. U'mi u'l'achar p'tirato. After his death, yesh lehem lasod ma shepasak lehem. If they gave him a halacha, then they have to follow it. Da'ako yomav lo adorbe. He certainly didn't reverse his position at this point, and he won't reverse it anymore because he passed away. So Rabbi Yochanan was protecting himself by saying, even when I tell you halacha, don't paskin like that unless you hear from me halacha namase. We just said that Amoraim in the Gemara, when they say halacha, it's binding. So then why isn't Rabbi Yochanan's statement binding? It was a chumrah that Rabbi Yochanan said, I may change my mind. So I want the opportunity to change my mind, and I want you to come back and check with me. If I say halacha namase, then I'm certain. And then you can go off with that. If I just say halacha, then I'm uncertain. But what the Rishbam points out is, once Rabbi Yochanan passes away, then whatever he said halacha becomes halacha namase, because he never retracted the position, and therefore the decision is binding. And that's how he fits it into his thesis here, that whenever the Gemara says halacha, that is a binding halacha. Okay, Amalu Rav Rovo, the Rav Papa, the Rav Huna Brei, the Rav Yeshua. So Rava says to his students, Rav Papa and Rav Huna Brei, the Rav Yeshua, ki ate piska de dina de dila kamaychu. If you get a psak halacha from me, you get a case law that I wrote up and I give a psak halacha and it comes before you, v'chazita behi pircha. And you have a question on it, meaning that you are in disagreement with the conclusion that I came to Psak Halacha. Lo tikro, don't rip it up, until you come and check with me. And we have incidents before with Rav Nachman and Rava. Rava might have been schooled by this in the court of Rav Nachman, because Rav Nachman would give Psak Halacha, and Rava, who was his Talmud, would question Rav Nachman. And Rav Nachman said to him a couple times, then I tell you, don't ask me in the middle of a case. Or, Rav afterwards will say, you know, I asked the question, but the question was improper, because Rav Nachman's right, I didn't think of this circumstance, or I didn't think it through properly, or Rav Nachman answers him and says, you're wrong in that assumption. So Rav has the same experience with Rav Papa. Rav Papa questions him, and Rav Papa himself says it wasn't a good question, Rav was right about this. So Rav is saying, when you have a Rebbe who's giving these piskei halacha, and he is writing up the verdict in cases, if you disagree with it, you need to check with the person who wrote it before you go on to conclude that it was wrong. If I have a reason which explains or supports why I said this and disproves what you said, I'll tell you it. If not, then I'll reverse my position. But it's helpful to me, first of all, because if I know I got something wrong, now I know I need to reverse the position. And it's helpful to you, because if you come to me, I might be able to explain why you're wrong. So there's a value in counseling with the individual wrote the Psak Halacha to understand why they wrote the Psak Halacha and whether they agree with your question that undermines that Psak Halacha. L'achar mita, but then you have a problem. Once he passes away, what do you do? Lo mikra tigru, don't rip it up. U'migmar nami lo tigru minei. But also don't use it to extrapolate or to take the din from it. It basically becomes a hanging psak, which is that the psak is still there. Don't rip it up. But on the other hand, you can't use it as a basis for other piskei halacha. Lo mikra tigrine, don't rip it up. Di'avai hatam d'mava amina l'chutayma. Because if I was there, maybe I'd be answering your question. So as the Rashbam says over here, you keep it around because maybe you'll find the answer that I would have come up with. So you can't be so certain of yourself to go ahead and rip up my Psak Halacha. My Psak Halacha came from somewhere. Did I make a mistake? Possibly. But are you able to say that definitively? The answer is no. So therefore, Hank, keep it around in case somebody figures out afterwards the reasoning that overrides what you were thinking now. Now, most Rishonim limit this to a Talmid, to a student vis-a-vis his Rebbe, because there he's bound by his Rebbe's Psak because of the Mesorah, especially, or most importantly, in cases that are similar to each other. Whereas if it's a Psak from another party, then you're not bound by that, because again, as we're going to see in a second in the Gemara, then the Dayan has to follow his own intuition in these situations. On the other hand, Migmar Nami Lo Tigmru Minei, don't extrapolate from it, or don't be bound by it, because the Ein LaDayan Elamasha Einav wrote that a Dayan is only bound by what he sees. A Dayan must follow the logic that he feels is the proper understanding of the sugya or the proper understanding of the Psak Halacha. And over here, where you see a Psak Halacha from me and you disagree with it, even though there might be good reason for it, but until you can come up with those reasons, you have to follow your intuition. And you have to follow your own logic over there. And that's what the Rishbam says. Anything to do with Svara, you have to follow the logic that is dictated to you by your conclusion in the case or your view of the case. That applies both to Halacha, when we're saying what's the Psak Halacha, as well as what's the logic or the logical way to interpret this case. All of those are in the hands of the Dayan. So he can have a Mesorah from his Rebbeim, but that Mesorah from his Rebbeim only dictates when he doesn't have an alternate view. If he has an alternate view, he has to try as hard as possible to figure out why his Rebbe said this, and he has the right, in the end, to disagree with his Rebbe as long as his Rebbe's not alive. If his Rebbe's alive, he's got to go and take counsel with him and find out why. But if he's not alive, then he has a right to go by his own intuition, his own Psak Halacha. Obviously, this is only someone who is qualified to do such. You're not automatically qualified to make those decisions and disagree with the other parties when you don't know anything. You have to be on the level where you are considered or classified as a judge, and someone can give Hora'ah and Psak Halacha, and in that right, you are now given a green light to do things in the way that you think are right, in the way that you think are logical, and you can then go against previous Piskei Halacha. Again, you have to have respect for the Mesorah, you have to have respect for those that came before you, and so therefore you have to give deference to them. That's what Rava says, don't rip it up, because maybe people after you will see it. And that's also why, with regards to Girsa'ot, whenever you have a Girsa in the Gemara, people don't just change the Gemara. They change the Girsa by putting a little letter there and saying, I think it should be this way. I think it should be that way. Because maybe later on, someone will come up with a way to explain the Girsa the way it is. So we don't want you erasing what's there and putting in the new Girsa. We want you amend it, but amend it on the footnote it, but not do it in the Gemara itself. So that way people have the alternative that you're giving. But you're not erasing what was originally there. So that's what the Rabbeinu Tam always complains about his older brother, the Rashbam, that when he changed the Girsa'ot, he literally changed what was in the Gemara, and that he was so certain about the changing that he had a free hand to change things, and he didn't take more caution. And therefore, the Baalei Tosfot, the Rabbeinu Tam, many times will disagree with the Rashbam, and sometimes with Rashi as well, in their changes of the Girsa'ot, because they think that the original Girsa was binding, or the older Sfarim have an alternate Girsa in them. And that's the importance of leaving the alternate Girsa intact, because sometimes you come back to it and you realize you made a mistake or you reinterpreted it wrong, and then you give people the ability to make that decision by leaving the information in there. It's the same story over here. If you're going to go against my Psak Halacha, don't rip up my Psak Halacha. Leave it there so people have the ability to look at it and make decisions. But in the meantime, you can go after whatever you think is correct or whatever you think is the right way to adjudicate the case. You're right. Nothing is carved in stone, but you have to have the deference for a Mesorah or for people that came before you. You can't be a freewheeling cowboy in Psak Halacha and just go out on his own independent way without the consideration of that which came before him, and that's which governs the halachic process. Tzitz Eliezer and Rav Yosef wrote that they disagreed with Moshe Psak with regards to violating Doraita as coming back from a call, a Hatzalah call. Nevertheless, they say Rav Moshe said it, and they give deference to Rav Moshe. They say, we don't think that's what the Gemara says. They don't think that's what the conclusion from the case is. But if Rav Moshe said it, they're not going to argue on it. That's showing a certain amount of deference to the Mesorah, to someone who is a tremendous posek, and not just dismissing what they're saying. They are dismissing it because they don't believe it's right. And they will give Psak Halacha based on their thing, but they will not undermine what Rav Moshe said because it was Rav Moshe who said it. That's an important part of this, in the deference to those that came before you, to the Mesorah, that a person can't be a cowboy and go out and just say, what everybody said before me is wrong, and now here's the new way to deal with it. They can't be this freewheeling cowboy in Psak Halacha and just go out on his own independent way. Okay, we're going to stop here, two lines down on the top of Kuf Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph.